Culture eats strategy for lunch, and informed cultures drive decisions and inspire action. At the Data Culture Podcast, we talk with execs, visionaries, and data experts that you may move from idea to outcome in your own data culture journey. Welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. My name is Sid Atkinson, data culture innovator and consulting leader with over 21 years in data.
And I'm Lee Harper, AI human with over a decade doing AI stuff.
And with us today is Jeremy Kingry from Argonne. He is the director of strategic engagements over there. He has a long history in many things data and doing all sorts of awesome engagements. Jeremy is here today to talk to us about some living and breathing data. So in particular, one of his goals is helping drive M&A and M&A activity analysis. And at Argonne, they are building from scratch, an operational model that is entirely driven by data. And this is going to light up how they can evaluate, you know, targets, acquisitions, rolling things in, rolling new companies into their professional services organization, but also then post-acquisition, how you drive alignment. So I'm really looking forward to the discussion. Jeremy, welcome. We're excited.
Hey, thanks, Sid.
Jeremy, for everyone, so we talked about just introduced the topic. We're going to talk about M&A activity, post-M&A activity, and how data really helps y'all make wise decisions. But before we get to that, if you don't mind, just give the quick story on Jeremy in the data space and how you came to love all things insightful and wise.
Okay, great. Yeah, so I've been dealing with data for, oh goodness, it's pushing 30 years now. Started right out of college. Worked for Shell Oil Company, and we were working on what's called SCADA systems back then. So essentially, these were intelligent systems that collected telemetry, such as flow rates, pressures, things like that, in an oil production field. So think of your wellhead and detecting pressure there so it doesn't blow out, and alarms set around that. And even higher level software layered on top of that to maximize oil field production based on a given target for the day. So that was pretty cool, high tech engineering stuff using real time analytics, and went on there to work in a lot of different industries. Actually, I worked in defense industry for the Air Force. I worked in the financial industry for one of the nation's largest wholesale mortgage companies that was shut down in 2009. And finally, I got into the world of consulting and professional services, and specifically within the Microsoft channel. And I've been in the Microsoft channel for professional services all around data for, ever since about SQL Server 2008 was pretty fresh at the time. So it's been a little while with that. And since then, I've been through several different companies, as well as several different acquisitions of the companies I was working for that kind of led me to where I'm at today, kind of focusing around the data around company acquisitions and operationally building a company from scratch for the professional services space, which is a nice new experience for me because, in our little niche in the Microsoft world, we had been focusing on manufacturing, mining, materials for a long time. So I can tell you about lean manufacturing and inventory turns and things like that, but it has no bearing whatsoever on my professional services background and building a professional services company. So it's a great learning experience there, and learning what those powerful KPIs and metrics are for our industry. It's very much like a law firm. Professional services is professional services. We're just different people at the top than lawyers at this point, but we're all billing based on hours, utilization. It's how we make our money. Overhead hurts a lot because it is a low margin business. So, it's a very interesting shift on things. We don't have to worry about raw material costs for anything anymore. So,
and there's always a value equation to, you know, how we decide what businesses we decide to go into. You know, we always talk about the main three vectors most people watch in a commercial enterprise, which is, you know, the how am I going to make money? How am I going to, you know, reduce expenses and making the money? And how am I going to de-risk things? But, you know, how I make those decisions and any of those three vectors is very different. And the framing on making those decisions is very different depending on the company I've started and why I've chosen to start that. You know, even people in similar industries or the same industry are going to make those decisions very differently. But so you at Argonne are very much focused on this M&A. So kind of frame that up. I loved how you put this. You're building this operating model from scratch. So describe this operating model that you're building from scratch, because I have to imagine how y'all are defining doing work is then also going to define how you evaluate, you know, companies as you're looking, you know, what are good acquisition targets?
Yeah, absolutely. So Argonaut has been in the process of acquiring companies for a couple of years now. We've been under the umbrella for almost 2 years at this point, and maybe a little over 2 years. And their goal is to produce a company that is really technology agnostic at the end of the day, even though we're all segmented within our different towers of technology. I'm in the Microsoft tower. We have a tower over here for Oracle. We have a Salesforce tower and so on and so forth. But the key is, no matter what our customers really need, Argonaut should be able to provide it. So if they're not looking for a Microsoft solution, if they determine Salesforce is the way to go rather than Dynamics 365, we can put them in touch with what we like to think the best is the best Salesforce team in the industry. So that's the stated goal, to provide that seamless level of services, one place to go for all of your software needs and data business transformation needs. So we're real heavy on that. So with that said, imagine you're buying six companies and each one is on a different finance system. Each one is on a different sales system, different marketing systems. You're trying to pull all of those together under one corporate umbrella. In a sense, you kind of let them operate independently, but you got to consolidate finances at some point. You really have to figure out where talent is between different organizations so that we can share between organizations. And with that, the choice was made that we need a common software platform to really onboard all of these new acquisitions into so that we can run the company. And we have one single way of running the company rather than 20 different ways from all the different 20 different acquisitions we have. And we've got companies we've acquired that are on QuickBooks. You know, these are smaller companies in South America. They're running QuickBooks online. We've got some companies that are on Oracle Financials, you know, and Dynamics 365 is what we were on, finance and supply chain. So what we did, we got together an enterprise architecture steering committee and kind of put together the vision of what the company's going to look like as far as software goes. We know what we do for a business. We got some experts figured that out after a long debate, and then decided we're going to go through our list of skill sets and pick our quote unquote best of breed applications for the different functionalities of the companies. So when you think about software used to run a company, the first thing that comes to mind is an ERP, enterprise resource planning software. It can handle everything from your accounting to inventory. In the case of us, we're using the professional services add-on for Dynamics 365. So it handles projects and all of the management and staffing that is involved with those projects, and that rolls straight into the billing. So we did end up choosing Dynamics 365 for our ERP system.
And but real quick, Jeremy, though, let's back up again, because what you just did is like similar to what we have happen in the movies when we're watching the documentary or something like that, right? It's like you see the founder, you see the key players in there, you see that some like those initial discussions, and then they do like the time-lapse montage, right? Where it kind of passes over for like us, which is actually some of the most important decisions that are made in those rooms, right? And so you mentioned we got some folks together to figure out enterprise architecture, the steering committee. Those are big things, right? So how did that go, right? Like how did it, it's like you're sitting there saying, okay, we're in services, but we're kind of deciding whether we're in services or not, right? Like that is like existential level decision making. And then after you decide like, hey, we're in services. We're going to be a services company. And now this is what it means to do certain things below that. You know, how did that unfold, right? Like that, like I love the fact that you said y'all started with why, validate who we are, what we are and why we're doing it. Now you're going to dive into the details. So great start. Kind of, you know, tell us what you know about how that flowed out.
Oh, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears.
yeah.
Some of the towers obviously were larger than other towers and wielded a little more influence. And the Microsoft Tower was one of those towers. Believe it or not, the Salesforce Tower was another one.
Mm-hmm.
Based on our expertise on doing global enterprise-wide deployments that Arbella had with Dynamics 365, we were chosen to be that model. It is a forward-facing product. It's mm-hmm. not an old product. I don't want to disparage SAP or anything like that, but Microsoft has invested a lot in being innovative in the cloud-based enterprise space. Mm-hmm. And after looking at features, after looking at needs, and looking at cost as well, we have to weigh all of these things in because we're a cost-sensitive business. You know, we make money on people, and we can only make so much on people. People aren't going to pay us $3,000 an hour for a consultant. They just don't, you know. So mm-hmm. we've got to work within the margins we have, and that drives you towards, hey, we do absolutely weigh costs when we're doing our best-of-breed software. We absolutely have to have something we can implement in-house. So it came down to just a couple of choices between Oracle, which, you know, is getting long in the tooth, maybe PeopleSoft, but, you know, the real big fight was between SAP and Dynamics 365. And we had a larger team. Our SAP team is mostly just sustainment of existing client base. They don't mm-hmm. sign a lot of new business, so they had less experience in new global implementations than we do on the D365 side. And that's kind of what drove that decision, is literally we had the expertise to do that global implementation and sometimes run two concurrently at the same time.
I know it's funny because I think it's worth mentioning. It's like, you know, I love the point that in some ways your what is a good decision, what is the best decision, is also working within, you know, where do we have momentum and where do we have skills and where do we have people, right? Like you said it right there at the forefront, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears that went into basically these two towers, the ones with the most experience. And then inside those two towers, the SAP and the Dynamics Tower, you know, the Dynamics Tower had a lot more global experience, a lot more new experience, a lot more new customers. You know, because conversely, I'm sure there's somebody else in the world who is going to listen to this. It's like, well, wait a minute. My SAP team's got some amazing experiences, right? But that's the point. Like, this was a good decision for your group, your team,
right,
on this. So,
and that's really at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to do is fit the architecture to what works for us. And I think every mm-hmm. company really needs to do that. There's no one size fits all. Even though selling Microsoft software for a decade, obviously I've said, oh, well, Microsoft can do that, and everything. But at the end of the day, you start getting in and actually dealing with your competitors as mm-hmm. friends now and people within your company, you start to really learn the strengths and weaknesses of all of the different platforms, not just mm-hmm. the Microsoft platform, not just the SAP platform. So you really start. In my opinion, I think it would make someone a better salesperson in the technology world to understand the strengths and weaknesses of each of these platforms. So going through this kind of selection criteria is absolutely valuable experience.
I think that's why we talk about often cultures, not just a culture, right? Because the culture you create as a company is a function of all of these things. It's a function of people that you have today. It's a function of where you want to go in the future. It's a function of the process that you have, and again, what you want to achieve in the future. And so that's always going to be, although how we can get to that decision might be some universal truths about that, the actual final choice that we make is never going to be universal. It's always going to be very, you know, specific to our context, situations, industries, experiences.
So now it's like kind of where I'm, you know, we're still talking in some ways about step one. You're setting up this new operating model for Argonaut, you know, for the operating model for what's going to scale. In some ways, you can kind of say you're, you know, the Dynamics team being chosen for the basis for this new platform and the new operating model. It's like you're taking all these learnings you had from customers, right? It's not just you, you know, you are going to taking learnings from customers. Now you're consolidating all those learnings from many implementations with customers to figure out, okay, now if we're going to take a fresh step at building a platform for Argonaut to further scale, this is what we're doing. Awesome. All right, well, keep going. We interrupted you there.
Absolutely. So beyond just picking the software, and I'll tell you, we did end up with Salesforce, which, you know, hurt my soul that we didn't go with Dynamics for that. But in retrospect, now that I'm, you know, messing around within the Salesforce environment, messing around with the APIs for it and stuff, it's a good choice. I absolutely see things it's better at than the Microsoft Dynamics. And I see things that Dynamics is better at than Salesforce. So, you know, I think there's somewhat of a parity there, but I feel like maybe we made the right choice on Salesforce as well for our particular situation. And moving down, the important things around data were we decided to go with Azure Data Lake and Synapse Link Analytics, as well as Power BI for our reporting. It was just a more mature tool set. Had a broader breadth of features. And once again, you know, we're looking at cost as well. So the costs are going up. We are using Power BI premium capacity. We have that number of people now. We're over 2,000 Power BI licensed users at the moment. We don't even have everybody live yet. It'll be 3,000 by the end. And there really is no end, but 3,000 at the end of the people we have right now. And next year, maybe 4,000 or something, right? So we ended up going with Azure Data Lake as well as Power BI, and that's kind of why I was chosen to lead the project rather than someone coming from the Oracle side of the house. The neat thing about the project, more than just choosing the right software, and I think this probably is more important than the software choice at all, is the fact we get to define our organization. We're creating new master data. I mean, obviously, when you think about master data, employees, master data, right? That kind of stuff. There's nothing really new there in the last 20 years, unless you take like standards in there of data privacy and things like that. But come into your organizational hierarchy, we get to make it from scratch. And you'd think that would just be the best idea ever, and it's just going to be perfect. But we're like on iteration 4 of that. Yeah. And as we keep bringing more and more people live, we keep seeing our mistakes we had in the past in regards to, you know, we have a concept called planning roles, and that's part of our staffing, right? We have a project, we're going to need 3 ABAP engineers, we're going to need 4 data engineers, and those are planning roles. They don't have a name associated with them, and we've been back and forth on planning roles. Are they tower specific? Are they not tower specific? And things like that. Well, in the end, they absolutely have to be tower specific. I need an Azure data engineer. I don't really need a Oracle data engineer, you know, for this. So, but yeah, the picking that master data and a master data solution has been challenging to say the least, but a really fun exercise, actually. I mean, once again, we're starting something from nothing, and we're really focused on the operational side of things right now because it's how we run our business.
Well, so talk a little bit that, you know, there's, I love how y'all are, it be a misnomer or misstatement, not misnomer, misstatement to say that Argonaut's new, right? Argonaut's not new to professional services. The team you have is not new to professional services, but you are treating this whole build out as if it is new, you know, redefining things. So talk a little bit, you know, so yes, it's a very important, all this redefinition. We've walked through a couple of things on the key decision points there. But then there's the acquisition side of this too. And we can kind of circle around here a little bit on now that you're defining what you feel is the right operational model for Argonaut at scale, that is helping as you go to look at acquisitions. So talk a little bit about that. Like, but how is this definition and the data and the entirety of this operational model and all the telemetry coming out of this operational model, it's helping Argonaut, not just Jeremy, you, Jeremy, it's helping Argonaut look at these acquisitions.
Well, traditionally, when you think about an acquisition, there's a couple of things that drive an acquisition. And I'm not a complete expert on M&A, so I might miss a couple of items. But, you know, the first thing that drives an acquisition is need. Do you need something, right? And that need could be, we want more revenue. So we're not inventing salespeople overnight. We're not inventing customers overnight. So we got to go buy those things at this point. Growing organically is a much slower process. Number two is, what is it going to bring for you? Let's say you need this, but what does it bring? And how do you measure that it actually fulfills those needs? And that's always been the quandary for us. We can take a look at the company and we can look at the finances they give us. Past performance does not indicate anything about future performance of the company. So if you're buying something for just headcount, fine. I mean, that's great. You can buy almost anything if you got the right headcount. But if you look at the things you're buying and they're not performing well, it gives you a question mark all around. And to be able to determine if they're performing well, you've got to be able to measure that performance. And that's really where we've driven to create our, not so much our software stack, but our reporting stack around the software stack. We've created a generic model there that we can actually feed data in from pretty much any company, because we're buying companies and they may be on QuickBooks, they may be on Sugar CRM or some obscure platform if they're a small company, but we're able to provide them templates and say, dump your data into this each week. We'll dump it into some blob storage on the data lake, and we'll load it in and merge it into our enterprise data sources to actually get reporting on it. And being able to get consolidated finances, being able to get consolidated utilization numbers corporate-wide, so utterly important. And that's just the companies you own. Now imagine if you could give a potential acquisition target those templates and say, dump your ERP system into this. I want to see your GL. I want to see these numbers. I want to see your timesheets, your employee list, all that stuff. Dump it into here. You can make your employees anonymously named. I just need to know employee X, employee Y, employee Z, or whatever. I just want a higher level view of things. I mean, you could actually dump it at almost a department level if you wanted. I want to know what your utilization has been, what your anticipated utilization is moving forward. What does your pipeline look like? And I've got a common platform that I'm measuring my company on. The best way to measure an onboarding company would be through that same platform, because that's how they're going to be measured once they're onboarded. So we're really pulling data from these potential targets, that acquisition targets, once negotiations have started, obviously, and feeding them into our system. And it really opens up the view, particularly when you start talking about pipeline and things like that, and scheduled booked projects, right? So every company has a certain amount of dollars and cents and projects on the books that are to be delivered in the future. And we really want to see how you've resourced that. We really want to see how much bench you have and that kind of stuff. If we really need more headcount, maybe it's okay that you have more bench time right now and don't have that full utilization, because we can put them to work over here. But ideally, when you buy a company, you want them to be a top performing company. And we're looking for those best of breeds, especially for our larger acquisitions. We want someone who's an industry leader. And in order to do that, we've got to know and we've got to measure and see how they're trending. If they just spent $1 billion on a headquarters somewhere in Palo Alto, they're probably not a good target. It'll take them years to dig out of that hole.
On a related note to that, Jeremy, so let me ask a question on it. So now, by having a data-driven and much more prescriptive process for analyzing prospective acquisitions, I have to imagine that y'all are able to do more during your due diligence period than other companies might be able to do. So, i.e., I think everybody, any company acquiring another one, says, oh, yes, we want to see what you're doing new and different and better that we can learn from. And that almost never happens, because they're spending so much time doing the rote of what's your P&L, where's your book, where's your expenses, because they don't have a very streamlined process for understanding. Now, y'all are streamlining what is the table stakes in an acquisition, the financials. How is this company making money? How are they going to integrate and what we're doing? So by streamlining the table stakes, things that should be table stakes in every M&A deal, are you finding Argon is able to do a little bit more that other, acquirees are not able to do?
I say it absolutely gives us a competitive advantage. Being able to do that during the due diligence phase, as you mentioned, think of any purchase you do in your life. Think of buying a house.
Yeah.
Lately, we've seen some crazy things, particularly you guys out there in Texas, but me in Florida as well.
Yes.
I think we're both ground zero.
I know where
for
you're
that.
Going. Yeah. I know exactly where you're going. So
I've seen people buying houses sight unseen, waiving inspection, $20,000 over asking price.
Yep.
Now, if you go in and acquire companies that way, you're going to go out of business. You will simply drive yourself out of business. These are the biggest acquisitions you'll make in your life, and you've done zero due diligence. So what does due diligence look like? Well, first, let's look at the P&L statements. Let's look at their past taxes. Let's look at their headcount, stuff like that. But what's the next level, right? Now, imagine you as buying the house, you hire a home inspector to come in and see what's wrong with it before you make, you know, before you finalize your offer or, you know, that's fine. That's looking at your P&L. That's looking under the hood a little bit. Now, imagine if you could live in the house for a month or however long your due diligence period is with your home inspector there. Yeah. Going through day by day, looking at the intricacies and little cracks and crevices everywhere. And I like to think that that's the competitive advantage we're getting here. And in a high inflationary period, I think that that makes a huge difference in surviving and growing. And by doing that extra step, by what I say is giving us a competitive advantage for that step, I think that's us growing, and we're able to grow with that and make less mistakes along the way.
So has there been anything, because you have taken this approach and taken the investment and time and energy and blood, sweat, and tears, and I'm sure a few wrestling matches to decide how this stuff gets done, what have been some unexpected stories or benefits in doing this?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question that I'm completely not prepared for, Sid. So,
no worries. We can come back to it later if you think of something.
Yeah, let me think on that one real quick and just next question, please.
Oh, sure. What have been some of the unexpected pains in doing this process? You know, it's like we all go into it with like a lot of good ideas and good intentions, and you know what many of us as the technologists know is the art of the possible, but then we always run into some pains in doing this, pains culturally, pains from things not working out as expected. So what are some of those things that you run into?
I will tell you a few pains that I've experienced myself on this project, and then, you know, go into a larger picture on those pains.
Sure.
Because I think they're similar. Number one, on Arbella, we have traditionally, as a lot of Microsoft partners have in the ERP space, worked with Ukrainian resources. Microsoft made a big investment in the Ukraine 10 to 15 years ago at their Polytechnic University to turn out employees who know how to develop in the Microsoft languages like X++ you have within Dynamics and, you know, .NET and things like that. So really good, smart group of people over there. Unfortunately, there's a war happening over there. And my entire team was Ukrainian. And
oh my gosh.
Month by month, I'd lose another one. Not lose them, but lose them for me as they get drafted into the war effort. Particularly my younger resources. That has created, you know, a hardship on the continuity of the project. We have a revolving door of resources due to that, which has really hurt us a little bit along the way, because we do lose some expertise. Granted, me being the architect over the project, I should carry most of that expertise, but there is a day-to-day into, I'm not building the reports. I'm not even digging into them that deep. I just don't have time. So some of that intellectual property is out there on the battlefield now, getting shot at, which sucks all around. And so that's been one of the pains that we've had. The other pains are egos. I've got people from this country who start complaining when someone from other country comes in to work on the project, and then rumors start circulating that I've got an Argentinian who's going to take over and run a Ukrainian team, who's going to then like have an Indian come and run everyone, and we're all going to be working for Argentina at some point. And these are rumors I've had to squash. That it's just, I don't even know where they come from, but you know, people have concerns about job security, particularly in an outsourced world. And we've really got to, listen to the whispers. We've got to keep on top of it. And I hate to say that it's personnel problems that have been my biggest issues, but it really is. And unfortunately, that's the nature of the professional services industry. we as an industry operate with a 25% attrition rate. It's feast and famine and a bloody business, honestly, at the end of the day, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. It's a great business model as well.
Yeah, it feeds your curiosity, right? Like if you're a very curious person, you love to see many different things. It can be a tough lifestyle from a standpoint, but it's also, I mean, Lee and I have joked, like sometimes people look at us and it's like, are you a masochist? What is wrong with you? No, this is so much fun. And you're just kind of like, you know, people wonder, like, do you not realize you're in pain? Just blink twice if you need help. No, really. I'm having a lot of fun here. I promise you.
Oh, I remember when I first, when I kind of started consulting, the boss I left at a startup was like, oh, consulting, it's its own beast, you know. Oh, what was it about that? I'm like, well, I like it. But yeah, a lot of people.
You start to see this, you know, when you get into it, and honestly, the weird thing, and I don't know about this is for you, Jeremy, but it was such a smooth and natural transition for me. My parents, you know, and my siblings, you know, love to joke and tease me and say, it's like, well, it was just natural for you because you're the oldest out of the four of us and you just like telling people what to do. Right. It's like, no, it's bigger than that. It's like, and by the way, I don't always tell people what to do, just sometimes. But I love just the exploration that we get to do. You know, it's new client environments, new decisions. Even if you end up with working with like 10 clients in a row in the same industry, you know, it's just fascinating what you can learn. I remember talking with my dad one time, my dad, doctor in the Army, 33 years in as a doctor in the Army, then went on to teach at a university for a little while. But then we were talking one time and I was explaining like global supply chain and what I was doing with this client. It's like, how do you know all this? It's like, so here's like somebody who's a pediatric neurologist stuck in like a very narrow field for a long time. And just, you know, he just loved hearing the stories and all the different things. And it's like, this is so cool, so fascinating. Because he's a little bit of polymath himself, always reading history. And it's due to him, I got into computers, right? As a doctor, you know. Building 286s and 386s and all this other stuff at home, but I love this, and obviously Jeremy, you do too. It's a special kind of fun. People, egos, all these things. You know, you get into consulting, you're going to have people who are very aspirational, very driven. Not to say other places too, but certainly there is such a rapid turnaround in the impact I can show I'm having in consulting, you know, whereas sometimes other companies you have to wait. There's a delay. There's a big time delay in the impact that you can have. Whereas here in consulting, I can easily see why you had egos to deal with, in particularly on global teams.
So yeah, I always promised myself I wouldn't be a manager in the consulting industry because it's like herding cats, but. Here we are, yes. Right? Consulting once again. I can't even tell my parents what I do. They don't understand it, right? They were both mm-hmm. school teachers. They just don't understand, and I have trouble explaining exactly what I do on a day-to-day basis too. So it's
fail that interview question then. It's like, how do you explain a database to a 5-year-old?
Mm-hmm. But as far as problems with the project, even rolling up, things we've encountered. Obviously, those personnel issues and egos and things like that roll all the way up in the project, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just around the data stack. It's not just that. It's company-wide. And, you know, it's things we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis to keep it running. But, you know, we managed to keep it running. And, you know, there's definitely egos because, hell, we've got a dozen people here who used to be owners of companies.
Yeah.
And now I'm telling them how to get their reports and telling them what to do and stuff. And some people are just great with it. Others will have an ego with it and stuff. So it's just, you got to learn how to deal with that. But, you know, a career of consulting has really taught me how to deal with the different kinds of personalities as well. So we make our way through it and get it done.
Yeah. Clear vision. Constantly communicated and constant expectation setting. But that's an interesting thing. I love how you mentioned just like those dozens, you know, the challenge on dozens of people that used to be owners. So now, so let's kind of like talk through the life cycle here. It's like, here, Argonaut's, okay, hey, we're going to reboot. We're going to rebuild from the ground up an operating model. That operating model is not only going to help us drive, you know, how Argonaut is going to work. And so achieve not only, you know, this kind of financial and operational excellence in its own book of business, but then also go look at acquisition targets. How do I, you know, how do I take my operating model and apply that to, you know, good acquisition targets? Because then I could see, oh yeah, if I apply Argonaut's operating model, we could get a potential lift of like plus 10, you know, in taking over this book of business, or, you know, plus 5 on the margins if we manage it this way, et cetera. But now this also helps post-acquisition as well. So kind of tell us a little bit about how, you know, you go, you define an operating model, you make, not only just define the operating model, but then take the important step of making that telemetry available, building it. Because a lot of people build a playbook, but not give telemetry, not give that data back. So now you've built the playbook, you built the telemetry. And now what's the impact as you're going out and now you post-acquisition? What is that doing for people?
Well, normally it's business as usual for the acquired for the first few months, probably. We do have a quick start toolkit, pretty much the same thing we did before we acquired them. Give us this data. We'll get it into our reporting infrastructure and ensure that at least at the high level, we get that level of capabilities. As far as scheduling your people and doing that, keep using the software stack you're using at the moment. And then we schedule them in our implementation. And we've been implementing for 2 years now. And when you think about it, when you re-engineer a company and redo, you know, a new ERP implementation for mid-sized companies, typically 6 months to sometimes a year and a half project, right? Mm-hmm. Depending on how many operating units they have and how complicated their business model is. We're bringing people online into the new environment, typically on a 4 month cadence. Mm. Wow. So we bring them online, we get their financials started, and we just do a traditional ERP implementation for them, bringing them in as a new legal entity under the Argonaut structure and Dynamics 365. A lot of user training, so especially at the PM level and above. So project mm-hmm. managers are kind of the key, I don't want to say low-level user for the system, but they're where the real big use starts because they're the ones who schedule the projects in Dynamics 365. They're the ones who are doing those kind of updates. Whereas a day-to-day consultant's in Dynamics 365 to do his timesheet at the end of the day, and that's pretty much it. Maybe it's Spence's as well. So from a strategic point, it's PM and up, a lot of training. A lot of training around how to set up these projects in Dynamics, because once a project's sold, it gets handed to our project manager. They set it up, they staff it, do all that stuff. And so they're the heavy users there of these reports, as well as the system itself. So there's intense training for them and everyone above them on how to do the day-to-day business and do it the Argonaut way. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not one of those who drinks a lot of Kool-Aid. But, you know, at least we are trying to make a consistent model of how we do business. And that's the Argonaut way. You don't have to be a cheerleader for it, but just learn it and do it, you know, and that's your job, you know, at the end of the day. So it, and it works out pretty good because now we can share all of those resources. If I need a project manager on a project somewhere else, I can share them because they all know how to set the projects up. They know how to staff the projects. They may need a little help on what those roles are for SAP versus Microsoft and that kind of stuff. But a lot of that's defined in the statement of work by the salespeople and the account executives. So it really does create a culture where you can swap people around and shift them back and forth as long as the skill sets align. And that consistency of doing business.
Yeah, and that consistency in doing business is a key thing. I'm a strong proponent of that because I think the tension that has existed for a long time in our space is that clients come to us when you can't make it work off the shelf, right? In professional services, in the IT space, in the systems integration space, like our niche is making things work that don't exist, or the process doesn't exist, it doesn't work out of the box. So there's a lot of beautiful creativity. And so we tend to get, you know, folks in this industry that love crafting, that love building, that love the creativity. I mean, this is why we all get drawn to this space. So lots of wonderful people doing lots of wonderful things. But what it doesn't mean, I've strongly feel, is it doesn't mean I should have a completely custom statement of work, a custom, you know, for every client, a custom status report for every client, a custom way to staff every project. But that has, I have seen that mistake repeated over and over and over. And so people say, oh, no, but we have a statement of work template. We have a staffing template. But do you? Have you looked at how, you know, like that gets pulled down and then everybody's ripping out the content that they want and putting other stuff in. Everybody's pulling that down and ripping out the content. Or as we have all seen, sales executives that keep old statements of work copied on their desktop and just boop, rehydrate that and send that off to the customer. How many times have we seen that kind
never
of stuff
happened.
Go on? Oh yeah, no. I actually, Jeremy, I know Argonne would never do that. But you know, there's lots of other people that would love to be acquired by y'all that do that, and they could benefit from it, from standardization. But the argument we've always made is like when you automate or operationalize the mundane, right? Then you can go back to crafting beautiful things, right? Somebody that's a master woodworker, you know, you wouldn't tell her like, hey, you're going to go build your own tools and then go build the cabinets you want to build. They don't want to do that. They might craft a custom tool for something new and unique that they're going to do. But beyond that, they want to use tools and build something beautiful that's going to delight the customer.
Hey, I think that's a good analogy. If we can make all of the tedious parts easier, I think is the way I like to look at it. It'll make your life easier in the long run, I guess. So, I guess.
Awesome.
But it does seem to be proving
so, Jeremy,
out. So.
It's y'all are on the path worth traveling and making far more progress than I've seen many other people make. So keep at it. You know, what are some interesting things that you are able to share that are coming, you know, down the road for y'all? And obviously, you know, there's a lot of things you can't share. There's a lot of things we haven't even talked about because, you know, in some ways we are in a slightly competitive space. But what is it that you can share that you're looking forward to learning or doing more to help with the operating model, to help with the acquisitions?
Well, I mean, there are some technological changes coming down the pipe. Some of them are being forced on us by Microsoft, such as going to Synapse Link versus the Data Lake Trickle Feed from Microsoft Dynamics. It's going to be an improvement, but once again, we've got to redo our entire underpinnings for that. So that's coming down the pipes. As far as other things coming down the pipes to improve things that we've learned from here, we are completely restructuring our planning roles once again. So that's coming to hopefully make us a little more accurate and competitive on things.
Yeah.
We've switched to, you know, we're going into shared sales, right? So we don't just have one salesperson going in. We might have a salesperson going in from Salesforce, a salesperson going in from that. We're also cross-training our sales staff. So they can sell multiple products or at least identify when they're losing a sale to a competing product and maybe call that product in. So there's a lot of stuff we can do there now that we've taken away, like you said, some of that mundane. Now we can focus on making the business expand, making it more versatile, more agile, and doing that. Now, as far as new technologies we're treading into, we're treading pretty lightly right now. I'd say there's a push to get more around AI and stuff like that. But, you know, like a lot of partners do, we're relying more on our larger software partner to do some of that, such as Microsoft or Oracle and stuff to kind of keep us ahead on that and integrate that within the product suite itself rather than us having to build it ourselves. We have built some accelerators through the years. Our Bella had a great data warehouse accelerator called our Bella Data Insights that was useful for a lot of years because it was very difficult to get data out of Microsoft Dynamics, particularly before it was called Dynamics 365. It was called Microsoft Dynamics AX is the product we were working with a lot. It's Microsoft's large ERP system, about 4,000 tables in the back end, 2,000 views, maybe up to about 6,000 tables these days. So it would take a year or two just to learn where to find something, you know, and become proficient as a data professional there. And we have this ADI suite that built some standard analytical models that we could deploy in a few days and then start customizing it from there. So you'd get your standard ARAP reporting and reporting around these different models out of the box with ADI and done quickly. And we would obviously sell it as a product. And so we've got more stuff like that coming. We like to expand upon the technologies that our software vendors give us to actually differentiate ourselves. And we've done that for a long time. So expect to see some pretty cool things coming out of Argo. I can't really get into the details of what they're going to do, though.
Oh, awesome. Well, I appreciate the story arc so far. And just to recap for everyone, we talked about, you know, Argo and this opportunity that y'all saw to go build a common operating model, knowing that there's a lot of growth by acquisition, a lot of organic growth, and then looking to, you know, shore up and continue to do well with the client base and the people you have. Like, how do you build a kind of next generation operating model? And then that is allowing, you know, y'all to very quickly evaluate acquisitions. You know, now if you know what the operating, you know, what you want as an operating model, you can evaluate many other acquisition targets against that operating model. Are we buying them for the people? Are we buying them for their market position? And then, you know, have strong ideas and telemetries about what a post-acquisition success looks like. And then after that acquisition, now with this common operating model, all the telemetry after that, you can then quickly integrate and make people feel, you know, maybe they might not be, you know, still wading through their new world, but at least they have information about what it's like to wade through the new world. So awesome story, Jeremy. I appreciate you sharing it with us today.
Thanks.
Cool. Well, Jeremy, if anybody wants to reach out to you, has a question on information you're allowed to share, you know, what's the best way? Should they reach out to you on LinkedIn?
Yeah, LinkedIn is perfect for that. Give me a couple of days to respond, as you've learned, Sid. So I don't check it every day. So it's,
well, that you did this because you're not in sales. That's why.
That is correct. I have, well, awesome. I've moved on to greener pastures in the past year or two.
Well, thank you again for your time today and look forward to talking again.
All right. Thanks, Sid. Thanks, Lee.
Thank you for listening and being an advocate of the data culture community. Curiosity intersected with data can inform and inspire change for the betterment of all. Let's build cultures to make this happen. If you have a topic, want to be a guest or chat, reach out to me, Sid Atkinson, or my co-host, Lee Harper, on LinkedIn via DM or via the Data Culture Podcast LinkedIn group. If you haven't already subscribed to this podcast, please do so anywhere you get podcasts. Be sure to join our LinkedIn group to engage with your fellow data culture changemakers and visionaries. Thanks again for listening.